sciences that he studied as handmaidens. In other words, he studied about the world in order to increase his knowledge of Torah. And the Vilna Gaon made the same statement. I don't remember the exact quotation, but to the effect that he had a certain ratio. The more a person increases his knowledge of the world at large, the greater will be his knowledge of Torah, because Torah is based upon a reality. But the truth of the matter is that it works the other way as well. And that the more a person gains knowledge of Torah, the greater will be his insight into certain patterns of nature, why the world has been created in a certain way, certain things that you couldn't understand just from the study of nature. And in this particular case, the area that I want to... by the way, if you're interested in a source to look up, another shiur on this topic... Rabbi Chait made this point in the shiur about the Kotz V'Dardar shiur, about the changes that took place after the Chait of Adam. And he explained the certain factors in reality, why they are that way in a metaphysical sense, because of the Torah, because the two worlds are interrelated. In fact, the Torah really, basically, is the book which shows the individual man how to relate to the world of nature that God has created. Now, I want to do it in a different area. Basically, I want to illustrate this in the area of history, how knowledge of Torah principles can enlighten certain areas of history. That's my basic objective. Now, I want to base it on a certain pasuk in Tehillim. Perek in Tehillim is a very important perek. It talks about the life of the tzaddik and the life of the rasha. Now, the last pasuk says, Ki yodei adoshem derech tzaddikim. The whole point is to show you why the way of the tzaddik is better, why the way of the tzaddik succeeds, as opposed to the way of the rasha. And what's the last three words? V'derech rishayim toved. But the way of the wicked is lost, must be lost. Now that is what I want to try and explain today. Of course, you could take it in a very simple way. I mean, you could say that the way of the wicked fails because God has total control over everything, and God will always come in and with his hashkacha and destroy them. I think that is not the sandesh. It's true, of course, but there's a deeper point over here. I think that it means that inherently, in and of itself, if you study the way of the rasha, the way of the wicked, you'll understand that it is impossible. The way the world has been structured, it's impossible for it to succeed. So we're going to try and elucidate the basic principles behind it. In other words, what is the underlying cause and effect over here? Why is it that the way of the wicked must fail? That's the basic objective. All right. Tovet. It's the last three words of the first perek of Tehillim. All right. The question is always discussed. You know that one of the objectives of Yad, this is for a person to obtain a certain degree of moral and ethical perfection. Now, we hold that a person can't really obtain moral and ethical perfection without knowledge, without Torah. And people are asking, you know, ein bor yirei chet, and ignoramus cannot be a yirei chet. So people are always asking, why is that so? I mean, why can't a person make himself into an ethical and moral person without Torah, just by practicing good deeds and so on and so on? What do you have to have knowledge? What do you have to have Torah for? Now, there's a medrash which illustrates this point. The medrash is on the pasuk in Bamidbar, Perek Chaf Aleph, Pasuk Chaf Zayin. It's talking over there when Moshe Rabbeinu had conquered some of the cities. That was the beginning of the Kibush of Eretz Yisrael on the other side of the Yarden, and the lands of Cheshbon, which were under the king Sichon Melech Amori. So there was a big victory over there. And the pasuk says, Al Ken Yomru HaMoshlim, therefore the Moshlim, what are the Moshlim? Moshlim are those who make Mashalim, who make what? Parables. Bo Cheshbon, come to Cheshbon. Tibana v'zikon near Sichon. Build up and set correctly the city of Sichon. There's a famous chazal attached to this. Baba Basra Dafayin Ches, Omrab Shmuel Bar Nachmeni, Omrab Yonasan. My dichsev, what does it mean? Al Kain Yomru HaMoshlim Bo Cheshbon. Therefore the Moshlim say, come to Cheshbon. HaMoshlim Elu HaMoshlim B'Yitzron. These are those, actually Moshlim means conquerors. The conquerors say, come to Cheshbon. Hamoshlim Elu Hamoshlim Biyitzron. The Moshlim, these are the ones who conquer their Yetzer, who conquer their inclinations, their instincts. Bo'u Cheshbon. Come to Cheshbon. What does it mean, come to Cheshbon? The word Cheshbon is the name of the city, but Cheshbon also means what? What does Cheshbon mean? Cheshbon means calculation. See, there's a double entendre, a double meaning. Come and calculate. Machshava, it comes from the word machshava, to think. Come and think. Bo v'nachshav cheshbono shel olam. Come and begin to think about the whole cheshbon of the world. Hefseid mitzvah, the loss of a mitzvah, kineged schara, as opposed to the benefit that you get from it. Uschara avera, the reward of the avera, kineged hefseida. Tibonav zikonen. And if you do this, imata osa kain, if you do this, if you use this method, you start to think, and you start to calculate about what are you really going to get out of the avera as opposed to the cost of the avera, or what you the tremendous loss of not doing a mitzvah as opposed to the momentary gain. If you do that, then you'll build up in olam hazeh, and you'll be all set for zikoni la'lava. So what they did is they twisted around the plain meaning of the pasuk, and they made it into a separate thing altogether. The pasuk is talking about conquerors, right? Those who conquer the city come to cheshbon. You know, you're feeling the exhilaration of the conquest. They said, no, that's not what it means. It's talking about something entirely differently. So what did they do? On the surface, it would appear that they just tacked on a moral lesson. They tacked it on to a place where there's a play on words. I think there's more than that. Because the question I wanted to pose is, is it simply two separate ideas entirely? You can look at it that way. The Pasuk is talking about one thing, the Medrash is talking about another thing, and for some accidental reason they tacked it on over there. But I say no, I say that there's more to it than just that. It's not just a matter of tacking on something extraneous. I think it ties in with the basic educational approach of Yadus. See, how does a person develop in terms of learning of ideas? The way a person's mind works is that he goes from the concrete to the conceptual. See, first he sees something in the physical, a certain emotional concept. And that leads him to a certain idea. He has a certain idea, which is not necessarily the true idea, the true concept. But once he's on that topic, once he's in that area, it's possible to lead him to a higher level of understanding. So do you see what they're doing over here? The pasuk over here is talking about what? Someone who is just a conqueror. That's a conqueror. So you have the image, you have a certain concept of a conqueror. Now, while you're on the subject of conqueror, while you have that concept, what are they trying to tell you? That this is not really the true idea of a conqueror. This is not. What you think, what you see over here, and you're overawed by what you consider to be a conqueror, this is not. The conqueror of a city is not really a conqueror. That's a false thing. It's a false idea. You see? Because the truth of the matter is that the conqueror, in most cases, is not a conqueror, but what is he? He's really the conquered. He's one who himself is conquered. He's conquered by an emotion. So if you're interested in being a conqueror, you see, if that's the subject, if that's what you admire, then at least you should try and understand what a true conqueror is. And the true conqueror is not the conqueror of a city. But the true conqueror is what? One who conquers his inclinations. That's why they tacked it on over here. It's not just a separate thing. It's because this is the way man develops. So it fits in perfectly. Now, there's a statement in Pirkei Avos which substantiates this. What is the statement? Ezeo Gibor. What is a Gibor? What is a strong man? Hakovesh es Yitzro. One who conquers his inclination. And they went further and said like this. Godol Kovesh es Yitzro milo chedir. What does that mean? We have to translate everything. Greater is he who conquers his inclination than what? Than one who conquers the city. So right off the bat, you see that there's a certain connection. The question would be, I mean, what is one thing? How could you compare one is greater than the other? I mean, what are you going to say, that the stones are greater than apples? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. There must be an underlying common denominator. So what is the underlying idea over here? What does it mean, greater is he who conquers his inclination than one who conquers a city? There's a very important underlying point over here. The point is like this. A person has to function in two frameworks, in two worlds. What are the two frameworks? What are the two worlds? First of all, he has his own subjective inner world of his drives, imagination, his ego, his desires. That's the subjective inner world. But then, there's another world out there, a world of objective reality, which is totally different totally different world and doesn't necessarily conform to your own inner world, your own subjective world. Now, what is the basic task of every person's life? Every person has to face a certain challenge in his life. And what is that challenge? What does it all boil down to? What every person is really struggling to do? He has to effectuate a certain type of a reconciliation, a certain type of relationship between the inner world and the outer world. That's the basic task of every person's life. So what are Chazal telling us over here? That there are two types. There are two ways to go about it. There's the way of the conqueror of the city. What is the conqueror of the city?
Doesn't he try to adjust?
Deal with the internal. He takes the internal as a given. He sticks with the subjective reality as a given. And he attempts to conform. To conform the external world. That's the conquest of a city. The conqueror of the city is trying to change, he's involved in trying to change the external world in order to conform to the internal world. That's one derech. And basically, as we'll soon see, that is the derech of the Rasha. What's the other way? The way of the tzaddik? Godol Kovesh Et Yitzro is the world that says no. He takes the world of objective reality, that's the true world, and what he's Kovesh Et Yitzro means he conquers. His act of conquest is on the self, which means to say that he adjusts his own self in order to be in conformity, in order to be in line with the external world of reality. Okay? He conforms his inner self. And through that, that's a tremendous job, a tremendous conquest. And you see also, from here, is that is something that can't be done so simply. You see another point, it's not just the strength of the conquest over here. You see, it takes strength, but it also takes something else. Chachma. You have to have chachmah for that. But I'm not really going to dwell on that right now. Now. This is not, I mean, the true giver. Yeah, the true giver. I thought you meant the conqueror. The conqueror doesn't try and change the self. He takes the self as the ultimate, as the given. And that, of course, you see, as I mentioned many times, he has to deal with the world of reality. Nobody is immune from reality because every fool has a reality principle. What he wants to do is he wants to take that and to impose it onto reality, to make that the reality in an external sense, in the external world. Now, a very... That's right. I'm using the word I said. There's a subjective reality, and then there is the... Yeah, is the smoke a problem here?
Yes, yes. Yeah.
What's the policy on the Sunday morning thing? But nevertheless, he does conquer a city. But the question is, you know, there's a battle and there's a war. There's the Mulchemes HaChayim. Right? So you have to understand, every general knows that the war consists of many battles. And the fact that you won one battle doesn't mean that you're going to win the war. Or the fact that you lose one battle doesn't mean that you're going to lose the war. See, conquering a city is one part of a whole battle. Now, the Tehillim says, Derech Roshayim Tovei. This is what I want to turn to. Now, interestingly enough, we see a very good illustration of this in the Megillah. In the Megillah. Of course, the character you know I'm referring to is which character? The character of Haman. Of Haman. Next week, save it, will you? Read the Megillah. If you read the Megillah, especially about after the behavior of Haman, after he was appointed and was given this tremendous honor, v'cholam karim mishtachim lo, right? And then, of course, we all know that Mordechai refused to do so. If you read it in an analytical way, I think you have to be struck with a tremendous kasha, something that just doesn't make any sense. What's the kasha? Of course, there's many questions, but I have one in particular. There's something that bothers me very, very much. What's that? Let me see if I can find the psukim. It doesn't make sense. It says that I got it. He appointed him vayinasei vayasim es kisso me'al kol sarjito chalav de'amelach hashem b'shem melach kerv mishtachim lohaman. Everybody bowed down to him kichenti v'lo hamelach v'morcha lo yichlo yishtachve. Then they told him about it, and it was when they said to him. Every day to Mordechai, and he wouldn't do it. They told to Haman to see whether Mordechai's words would stand, And then it says, and Haman saw that Mordechai doesn't bow down to him. He was filled with anger. He went crazy. And then Vayivas Bienav, it wasn't, I mean, we'll understand soon why it wasn't enough just to get rid of Mordechai. He had to get rid of all the Jews. But I think that this is really, should be, we all take this for granted. But really, it doesn't make any sense at all. Because put yourself in the man's situation. I mean, you can't assume that the guy was a fool. He wasn't insane. I mean, he was entrusted. Ahasuerus was the type of person, we said, who enjoyed the taiva. He enjoyed the... he was a man of lust. He enjoyed all the lust and the pleasures of the kingship, and he entrusted it to a man of ego who enjoyed the power. So obviously, Haman had to be a very capable person. Here he said, he finally reached the apex of his career. He got everything that he wanted. He got the position, he got the... And not only that, but everybody had to bow down to him. So, I mean, does it make sense that simply because of one insignificant person, I mean, Mordechai, we don't see that he was a very significant person, right? And one insignificant Jew refused to bow down to him, and he went totally crazy. Went, not only that, it wasn't that he was just filled with rage, but you see something else. You see, he said later on, at the happiest moment when he's invited to the party, right? And on the way back, he just, again, every time he saw him, every time he happened to see Mordechai, it just destroyed his happiness. He couldn't take it. Destroyed his happiness, right? And he says, V'chol ze eino shove li. All of this is not worth anything to me. Can you imagine? It just doesn't make any sense. I mean, any star, any person that wants the adulation of the crowd, if they're getting, I mean, you can't expect to have every single person. I mean, if you're getting a great deal, everybody's telling you you're fantastic, and there's one or two people that don't really care for you, I mean, it's not going to, you may be a little upset, annoyed. Depends. Most people won't even care. They'll say, that guy's nuts altogether. I'm great. I mean, you see, the whole world loves me. But to go, to say that all that adulation, all that fame, everything you want is totally worthless because of one insignificant person seems to be totally... absurd. So that's the question. In other words, but there are psychological laws over here that does make sense. And we have to try and understand why is it that when he had everything, it makes you kind of scary, you know, when you pursue that type of path, the emotional path, and you get the fantasy is fulfilled, you see that even then you might not be happy. You never know. What's the answer over here? What's the pshat? What do you have to premise? Go ahead. Little thing, by the way. It wasn't because he was afraid, you know, like you say, that others will follow him and this and that. That wasn't it. Because you see, it was more than that. You see that he said, it's all worthless to me. It was an emotional thing. It wasn't a practical, political thing. Hey, if there's one guy that questions me, others can question me, and then I'll lose my power. He wasn't worried about that. He could have just gotten rid of Mordechai if that was the case. I mean, besides, you see, he says, it's all worthless to me. I think you're on the right track. Go ahead.
No. Same type of,
See, a guy can be very happy. A politician is very, very happy. He enjoys his power and everything. But he realizes there's certain movements developing, and they could pose a threat to him, and he has to deal with them. I mean, he had all the power, the possibility. And besides, Mordechai was not the kind of person that was going around instigating. He wasn't an instigator. He was. It says he just refused to get up, and that's all. He didn't go around instigating it. Now, look. To go, I would say that even then, the fear that he is going to start, he didn't tell the other Jews, the fear that he's going to start a whole movement against Haman was really, really far-fetched. But even so, why should it deprive him? So that's a problem. He has other problems. He has enemies. I mean, it doesn't say that they were totally... And he's running an empire. There's many enemies. This is what he deals with every day. In fact, the infighting and to get on top and stay on top, I mean, these guys have this every day. That's part of their life. This is more. It says, V'chol zein
ha'shovali. Yeah. Well, I think the answers that were presented also, I don't think they answered why he had...
It wasn't enough just to kill Mordechai. Yeah, the other Jews weren't rebelling or anything like that. I mean, why would he have to...
Yeah, because he had fear that he'd see that this is the type
of... It's true. It's true, but I do think it's a bit far-fetched. I think the Pusik... You see, he says, I can't enjoy it. I can't be happy. That's when he got all his people together, the advisors. In fact, the truth of the matter is, and another, I'll tell you the real proof of that, though, that it can't be that. Because when did he come to the king to suggest that he kill Mordechai? See, if it was just the fear of the repercussions, so he had his plan to wipe out all the Jews on a certain date, and Mordechai would go with them. Right? And that was all set. So the practical problem, if it's a practical problem, was resolved. But he couldn't wait for that. He had to get rid of the guy right away. His plan was to hang him up right away. Now, if you're telling me that it's just because of the practical implications, that was where he had made the decision, it was solved, and they were going to be wiped out. When he came that night to the king couldn't sleep, and he was reading the records how Mordechai had saved him. It was because of the reaction. Esther had invited him to the party, so that was the apex of his emotional situation. Never felt better. And then he saw Mordechai, and he was wiped out. He gathered together his advisors, his wife, and everything, and he says, "Kol zeh eino shoveli. It's not worth anything to me." Now, you can't say that's a practical fear. So he had to go that night to kill the guy. He couldn't stand the guy's existence. Yeah.
Not having the thing at all.
Okay.
It's not the power he wants. He wants that feeling about himself.
Exactly. That's true. And that fits in with what we're saying, that it wasn't fear of the loss of power, and it wasn't the power per se that he wanted. See, Chazal really say that Mamuchan was Haman. Mamuchan, the one who suggested that he kill Vashti in the first place because she was thwarting the authority of the king. So you see that he operated on the basis of power and ego. So what does Mamuchan mean? They indicate Mamuchan means ready, a certain state of Mamuchan. This means you're ready for something. So what are they? In other words, he was in a state, he wasn't Haman yet. When he was elevated to power, his name was changed to Haman, which indicates that a change in his personality took place. What happens? It means like this. You see it happen very often that in all walks of life. Yeah. You see, certain people can appear to be very ordinary, humble, and not very ambitious, not egotistic, and suddenly they'll get a certain position, and all of a sudden they're total change in the person. They think they're tremendous, they're great, every thought of theirs, they become totally different people. I'm just giving this over very briefly. Now you see like this, what does it mean? It means that they had these emotions, this megalomania, these ego feelings about all along. But the point is, they couldn't express them because they have to have a certain situation in reality in which it could express itself. I mean, a person, as I said, every fool has a reality principle. I mean, otherwise, an insane asylum is one who has no connection with, he has his own reality. But so the megalomaniac, the dictator, is the one who does have a reality principle, and he's caught in the struggle. Now, in that state, that was when he was Mamuchan, he was in a state of conflict. He had these tremendous egotistical feelings about himself, this tremendous desire, this narcissistic feeling about himself, his greatness, but he didn't have the situation in which it could be fulfilled. So what was his struggle? Instead of struggling to adapt himself to reality, that it just doesn't exist in reality, you just know that he was trying to change reality in order to conform to his own inner image of himself. Okay? Now, once he got the position, then he was able to believe in his own mind he could effectuate the situation. Then he had the position, then he had the power, you see? And that brought out the full egotism. All right. Now, the thing is like this. You have to say one more thing. In other words, he believes now that he's operating in reality, that he's imposing his own view onto reality. But his conception of reality is different than the true conception of reality. This might get a little bit tricky. Just bear with me. I'll try and clarify that as I go along. What is reality for him? What is it? It's not the same thing as what constitutes reality for a Mordechai. I would say like this. You see this very often. A person that's functioning on the subjective level, in other words, he takes as reality all his feelings, his subjective feelings about himself. So what's reality for him? The subjective feelings of others. In other words, he recognizes that there are other people. So if he can convince them, in other words, for him, public opinion, if everybody tells him that he's great, that's it. Then he's great. So therefore, he has to create a situation in which everybody in the world is telling him that he's great. And that's exactly why everybody had to bow down to him. And that's why also every dictator, by the way, has to have total control over public opinion. There cannot be any freedom. He has to have total control because he has to be the one who controls all their information in order that he can achieve the type of impression in their minds that he wants them to have, that he's a great man. So that's his conception of reality. So when he was raised to power, as somebody just mentioned before, Richard, that it wasn't the power itself, but it was the desire to satisfy that emotion about his own greatness. And now he was able to feel that he achieved it in reality, because what's reality? What people think. Well, people, that's the only reality they recognize, the subjective feelings. So if you can control all the subjective feelings of all the people, that's reality. That's the reality of the dictator. Aha. So what's the problem with Mordechai? The truth of the matter is that he still faced an insecurity. There was a part of him that recognized that it's not true, that this is not the real reality. And he knows what he's doing. It's because they have to, and there's power, and this. In other words, he's living in a very strange type of a conflict. And there's a certain part of him which tells him that it's not true. He knows that he's not what he's pretending to be, if he could face up to those things. So what does he have to do? He has to repress that. He has to repress that side of him which says that this is all not true. That there's something wrong here, your whole system is phony, it's not true. And he has to, in order to do that, he has to be constantly reinforced by the opinions. The more he goes in front of the masses, the more he's involved in the adulation, then he can repress that other side of him, and the side of him which believes that that's the reality wins out. Now, it's very apt, the words, what does it say about Mordechai? What does it say? V'lo kam, v'lo zami menu. V'lo kam, v'lo two things. He didn't get up, and he didn't move before him. Now, what is the, are these two separate things? This is what killed, this is what destroyed him. When he saw Mordechai lo kam, he didn't get up, didn't rise. But more than that, it says, v'lo zami menu. Why does it have to tell us both? First, are there two separate things here? Or you can even ask the question, if Loza, if he didn't move, so of course he didn't get out. Well, what's the, how do these two words fit together? Go ahead. With you. Exactly. Go ahead, you want Alan? Yeah. Right. The low come by itself was not the worst thing. The Loza defines the low come. There's always a rebel here and there. I told you, you don't have to please everybody in the crowd. You know, you'll always find a rebel. Teacher, whatever, you can be a successful teacher and this and that. Most of the kids like you. You'll always find someone you can't please. You can't please everyone. That's a lot, so this guy doesn't stand up. Yeah, so you got to find a way of the that's for low come. Low come by itself wasn't the killer. Loza defines the low come. Why he didn't rise? Loza means he didn't move. What does that mean? That means that Mordechai was in a totally different framework of reality. In his framework of reality, in other words, the truth, there's nothing here. There's nothing to move. It doesn't even there's nothing even to move for. You see? He recognizes that this is an absolute zero. This is an absolute non-entity. This is what he couldn't accept. Because that one, somebody said it before, and this is where it fits in. Because he's struggling with that himself. It's his own inner insecurity, which he's always constantly fighting against. See, he's fighting a war against himself. He has the inner insecurity. Now, that one person, if a person has insecurity, you'll see this, performers mention this a lot of times, that they're performing for an audience, and let's say a comedian. I've heard the comedian say this. And they have the whole audience is gone laughing. There's one guy sitting there with like a stern face. They say that, what do they say? That the rest of the time they're only working on that one guy. The others don't mean anything to them anymore. It's that they're performing now completely to get that one guy. Why is that? Then who cares about the one guy? The answer is because he is really reflecting something that you fear inside yourself. Now, and therefore, you can't be happy anymore. Because Mordechai represents the true reality, which he can only survive psychologically if that is destroyed. And then he can deal with the other reality, the reality of the subjective opinions of others. That's why Mordechai has to be destroyed. That's why Chol Ze'eino Shoveli. You see? And that's why he couldn't wait. He couldn't wait for the date that it was set to occur. It had to be immediate, because he couldn't live. He couldn't enjoy. The party is coming up, the best time of his life. Every time he sees him. When he sees him, it arouses the sight of him, arouses that inner conflict. That answers the question of why the Cholam. That's why Cholam. Yeah. A lot of them had senses. You must assume that. You must assume, the way I see it, you must assume that there's a part, yes, because every fool has a reality principle.
And that was it. So why does he have to get rid of the rest?
Not every Jew was...
They say every Jew
bad after the world. But he said, yeah. You could force a guy. Right. This... And they produced the Mordechai. He realized he was a smart guy. By the way, that shows that he wasn't stupid. The decision to kill all the Jews, and that's a very good riot you bring, reflects the fact that he wasn't stupid. He was able to see that it wasn't just an individual. That's why Laurie mentions that all his arguments that they're different and they don't pay. They're separate. Aaron claims that it's true that they were coerced, they were bound, and this and that. Yeah, that's all true. But they produce they are the ones that produced a murder. In other words, it's not just an individual thinker over here. He surveyed the situation. If it's just the Socrates, one person all by himself, an individual, so take care of him. But he saw that he came from a certain movement. And you can see by the external signs that this is different. So all of his framework, his knowledge of reality is part of a whole system. And as long as that exists, he can never be secure. That's why Yves Vienov. It's pointless just to, it's ridiculous. So you get rid of this guy, but the root, the system is still there. You see, by the way, that's every dictator you'll see in history now. I mean, a very good insight. I'm not going to go into all the particulars on that point, but you see very often, in most cases of dictators, why they always come in conflict with the Jews. The Jews are different, and it's not the Jews are different, and they know that the Jews worship a different God, live in a different framework. They may not understand it as the way we understand it, as sophisticated, but they sense it. They sense that these people are in a totally different framework. That's what Mordechai. That's what Mordechai demonstrated, and that's why he had to be destroyed. That's all right. I'm ready to go on to the next step. Yeah, go ahead. Politically speaking, a protester, a troublemaker, a dissident would be maybe recalled for one reaction. He might have gotten rid of him right away. But you're right about it. Psychologically, it's much worse this way. You'd much rather have a student that argues with you and disagrees with you and fights with you and doesn't like your... No, I don't agree with anything you said today, rather than one that... just was not even moved, wasn't affected. Just you couldn't reach him in a totally different framework altogether. You got it. Right. Even the Nazi Yimach Shemam, I mean, they try to operate within the legal framework, whatever it is. And he too, he was a shrewd guy. You have to understand that he wasn't stupid. He was a shrewd man. He first of all surveyed the situation. He saw that would I'll tell you that would really ruin his plan. Why would he ruin his plan? Because his plan was to wipe out all the Jews. Right? Now, he sold that plan to Achashverosh in the guise, that's something else, if you go over the whole tape. He sold to him, he had to sell him a package. Achashverosh didn't care about the ego and the power, but he did care about the money, the wealth, right? The luxuries. So he made it cost-effective. He presented him a package where it wasn't cost-effective to keep the Jews around. They don't pay their taxes, and they speak their own language, and it's not worth it for us. It's not worth it for us. You see? Now, had he acted on the spur of the moment and killed Mordechai right away, that would have destroyed his whole plan, because then the king would have seen that it's a personal thing. Haman was smart enough to realize that he couldn't present the Achashverosh as a personal thing, so he hid the personal. Right? Now, he was also smart enough to control himself. Had he gone over there and wiped him out right away, how could he later on sell it to the king? The king would see right away it's a personal thing. So he was a smart guy. The truth of the matter is, the question would be how he intended to convince the king to kill Mordechai that night, to hang him up on the tree, because that was already a breach in his plan. You see, that's already a breach. That's why the Russia fails. That's a little indication of why the Russia fails, because he can't even effectuate his own plan. His own plan for his own ego is to wipe out the Jews, but already he was destroying his own plan by going ahead to the king and telling him. And you see, right now, you see that the Megillah just indicates that, because at that very time Achashverosh was beginning to think about how he had never rewarded Mordechai. You see, so right over there, by acting on the basis of his emotions, he was really hurting his own plan. All right, but the Megillah doesn't. The way it works out is through other means, other channels. Yeah, but it doesn't problem. You see what I'm saying? So therefore, it's no question why he didn't kill immediately. That shows that the guy was operating politically in an effective way.
Now he's just trying to calling up shots.
Go ahead, Jesse.
What is that?
You see, but like for example, in other words, like the Nazis, for example. So everybody always. People use an argument against reason, you know, that you say that reason is the best way to live. Here you have people that are the most advanced in reason and science, technology, and look at the terrible brutalities. So really you can't trust reason. I mean, there are people that use that argument. What's the answer to that? You do see they were men of reason. They were men of science. And they committed the worst atrocities. I do. There's many, many volumes of philosophical reaction to the Holocaust, which try and therefore say that we can't rely on reason. That's the answer. Were they truly men of reason? They, in other words, right. In other words, Aristotle defined man as a rational animal. You see, so they were animals with the use of rationality. Meaning to say that their mode of operation was based upon the instinctual. The basic premises, what determined their course of behavior was what? Yeah. Was the animal part of them. Now, an animal also uses a certain amount, whatever it has, I figure this, that. I mean, animals, some animals have more wisdom than others, yeah. But their use of whatever reason they have, well, I wouldn't call it reason, is to satisfy the instinctual, you see? So therefore, it's just the opposite. They were living purely in accordance with the instinctual. Except in trying to satisfy, like an animal will try and satisfy the instinctual through whatever means it has, they tried to satisfy, they saw that in the best way to achieve the instinctual goals through the use of, the concentration camps with gas, cost effective, efficiency, so on and so forth. In that sense, they used reason. But reason by them wasn't a free agent. The reason was totally enslaved to the instinctual. So it's not an argument about that. They didn't live a life of reason. All right? Every system of primitive religiosity, whatever it is, emotionalism, always has a certain ideological trimming. Because every person wants to believe that this is the truth. But he can't confront the reality, so therefore he tries to work out a distorted system to Mein Kampf, whatever it is. And of course, any psychologist can see through that it's just primitive, brutal emotions. But these emotions, right, cause him to try and work out a system which can justify those emotions. Okay. Yeah. The instinctual. The political system is set up to satisfy the instinctual.
Yeah, but it wasn't answering a threat, just...
If he was purely concerned with the political functioning of the kingdom, he wouldn't have acted this way. Of course, there was no threat to that. Mordecai, in fact, if... had he gotten to know Mordechai, the type of person he was, he would have seen that Mordechai had no desire to break down that system. If only he wouldn't give up, he wouldn't bow down to Avodah Zarah. But he would tell the Jews to not to buck the system. Our system tells us to get along with the powers, not to antagonize them. Not to antagonize the powers. So he would have seen, had he not been overcome by the emotion, and he was just concerned about the practical, he would have seen that there was nothing to worry about, because a man like Mordechai would never incite the Jews. Hold on, I think Laurie had a question. Promoted. Avi, you had something? No.
Are you?
V'derech Hashem Toved. And I wanted to explain why that's so. Why the Torah, which of course the Torah has insight into all the forces of nature and man, is telling us that it must fail. And I want to give some illustrations in recent history. What's the Pshat Derech Hashayim Tovei? What is Derech Hashayim? What is the way of the Russia? The way of the Russia is what?
To force external reality.
Exactly. To change external reality in order to conform to the inner desires. And it's because of that it must fall. It must fail. Basically, I'll give you... there can be many, many cases, many, many reasons. But the way I have three basic areas to illustrate. And I'm not going to... I don't have all... Basically dealing with World War II. With Hitler, you mashmo. And I don't have all the dates and the facts. One second. You could add... I just want to give an opening in the area. And you could add to it on your own. Find other cases and so on and so forth. Yeah. Emotional. Let's take a look, I think, in three areas. One area is like this. Because any system of the Russia is trying to change reality to conform to the inner, right? Now, what's bound to happen? At first, you see, he starts off strong. He's aggressive. The other party is unprepared. He has early victory. He takes them by surprise. But there always comes a point where what happens? There's a conflict with reality. Because no system, it's impossible. No matter how perfect your game plan is, you're always going to finally wind up with a conflict in reality. Okay? What's a good case in World War II? Stalingrad. That's one case. What happened to Stalingrad? Where's my military expert here? Spencer?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He went, in other words, he made the same mistake, by the way, that Napoleon made. Early successes, tremendous. He started out in summertime, you know, when the terrain, and Russia was unprepared because they had that pact. You see, he sets it up, he operated like a chacham at first. By the way, don't think that Hitler was a madman in the sense that he was crazy or a fool. Militarily and politically, he had a lot of brilliance, tremendous brilliance. So he made tremendous initial gains, and he pushed them back and pushed them back and pushed them back, and finally they got stuck at certain points. Now, one of the key decisive turning points of the war was Stalingrad, because what happened was there were some hesitations or whatever, but they got stuck, and the Russian winter came along, and they got bogged down with the Russian winter. And then the Russians, they were able to keep withdrawing in their industrial base. They kept rebuilding and planning for a counterattack. And finally, they found themselves in a situation where they were exposed to tremendous danger. Their lines were extended, exposed to tremendous danger. And all of the generals, you see, the generals were much more in line with reality. They weren't Hitler. They didn't have the same Nazi ambitions to the same extent, whatever it was. Now, all of them told them to do one thing. What do you have to do right now? Retreat. Now is the time to retreat. What did he do? What was his response? You can't retreat. He fired any general, any commander that says the word retreat. Is to, every soldier must stay there to the end, fight to the last bullet. And what happened? The army was totally wiped out. That was one of the major turning points. Why? Because he operates, what? Within the subjective, emotional, that he can't question. It's impossible. He cannot question. So therefore, whenever, it's impossible to avoid a conflict. There's always going to be a conflict with reality. When the key conflict with reality came, in other words, the external situation, which went against, his thing was the great conqueror, the fearless person who's always moving forward, always on the attack. When he saw a situation where he can't do that, he has to move back, he has to retreat, he has to withdraw, couldn't do it. Couldn't do it. The Derech Hashem Tovet. That was one example. There's another example. There's many. Let me just give you the ones. There's many, by the way. The more you read about World War II with these principles in mind, the more. Let me just give the ideas. Then you'll save again.
Sure.
Well, look. I'm giving you a certain look. I'm not going on. I know that it's fine. We see that he didn't. The reality is that he didn't.
No, that's not what he said.
The Nazis in the World War II, because they started out with tremendous gains. They made revolutionary changes in warfare, and the rest of the world was totally asleep. I mean, they were amazed. He made greater conquests and quicker. He took over the whole Western Europe than Napoleon had done. And he had the world reeling. So the amazing thing is how from that tremendous position of strength, right, he wound up in total devastation, total ruin. So I'm trying to point out certain turning points. I mean, the more I read about it, and you see more press and more particulars. Of course, the Russia. Of course, the right. If you would have abandoned this framework, you see, and listened to his generals, then they would have he would have gotten out of it. But that's Derech Hashem Tovet. I'm going to show you afterwards. I'm going to show you a medrash about Og Melech HaBashan, which sums up the whole thing. Okay, so it was slightly the same basic idea. What happened? Is everybody familiar with what happened to Dunkirk? Oh, so then how would you? Ben, let me give it to you very quickly. The fact, you don't have to know all the facts. But in the early phases of the war, you see the Allies, England and France, they were basically asleep. They were trying. They were also involved in self-deception. Munich, the Sellout of Munich, they were trying to buy him off. You see, appeasement, the whole policy of appeasement. Now, once they tried to explain away every conquest. He conquered the Sudetenland and the Czechoslovakia and this and that. Everything they tried, that's it. If you give him this peace, he'll be happy and satisfied. All right. Finally, when he invaded Poland, they had a commitment to defend Poland. That's when they declared war. So France and England, they declared war against Germany, but they were totally unprepared. And if France was resting on its laurels, the Maginot Line, and Hitler had already revolutionized, he had perfected. See, in World War I brought out some new things like a tank, airplane, but they weren't perfected. So he, in the intervening years, he went ahead and perfected all new tactics. The Panzer, Blitzkrieg, dive bombing, the whole business. And, of course, the others, as always happens, the victors were resting on their laurels. They weren't prepared. So he sliced through France and the Maginot Line like butter. And nobody could believe how quickly he got basically to the beaches of the Channel, the English Channel. Now, there was a British expeditionary force. England had sent over an expeditionary force, together with the French, they were fighting together, comprised an army of about 300,000 or more, almost 400,000 men, which at that time was the bulk of the English army. Now, in order to... Hitler's ultimate ambition was to wipe out Russia in the east. He wanted to make them, he considered them to be subhumans, and they should be the slaves for the Germanic state. In order to do so, he had to get rid of France and England. They were the only opposition. Now, they pushed so quickly and so fast that this whole British expeditionary force, which if they would have been wiped out, then he could have invaded England because there was no army left, were surrounded in a pincers on the beach of Dunkirk. At that point, they were defenseless, they were surrounded, and the armies could have marched in and wiped them out. And suddenly, this is a big kash of historians, suddenly the army stopped. The advance stopped and was halted. And they gave them a certain amount of time to regroup. They lost a few days, were very crucial, a few days to get together, to regroup. Then they began the famous evacuation of Dunkirk. England, right, the boats. England was, of course, a tremendous naval power. And they evacuated, they sent everything that could float, rowboats, yachts, cruisers, destroy, whatever, name it. That's what's exactly what happened. Constantly, up and back, they were ferrying men, ferrying them, all right? Now, nobody understands really what happened. Hitler was on the verge of his biggest success. Had he wiped them out, it would have been kind of over. What happened? What's the true story? You put it together from some of the good works on the subject. They're not exactly 100% clear, but it seems like this. This is my interpretation. It's borne out. They all mention these facts. It's a suffix, what it is. You see that the Derech Rishayim, Socrates said about this, that a band of robbers, that when Hitler came to power, he had his own Nazi, you know, his own Nazi party behind him. And many Nazis took over key positions in the army, Air Force actually. Goering was a Nazi. He had brought him to power. But Hitler never got along 100% with the Wehrmacht. The Wehrmacht was the German army. They weren't Nazi. He had to deal with them, and he always had to say they weren't won over to his... He had the power, but they weren't Nazis themselves. He always had a conflict. He never trusted the Wehrmacht. At that particular point, there was a battle for glory between Goering of the Luftwaffe, the Air Force, and the commanders of the army. Now, the commanders of the army came to him and said, now's the time, let's go in and wipe him out. Goering, however, was concerned about his own glory, the Luftwaffe. So he managed to convince Hitler that what? Leave the job to the Luftwaffe. All right? And the Luftwaffe, the army does it, the army will get all the credit. And that'll strengthen their position at home. I mean, you're involved in a perpetual struggle with them. If I do it, I'm a Nazi man. I'm with you. Let the Luftwaffe, and he assured them we'll wipe them out from the air, be no problem. So therefore, the guns, the army was ordered to stop. In the meantime, every day was precious. So they organized certain defenses around Dunkirk and began to, in other words, when the army finally did move a few days later. Now, all this time, they had no conception that the British were capable of pulling out this evacuation. When they began to see what was happening, that they were sending over these boats, at first they laughed like a joke, then they saw 50,000, 80,000, 100 escape, then it was time to send the Luftwaffe into action. But then something happened. What happened, Spencer? Cloudy weather. The airfields were blanketed in clouds, and the airplanes couldn't fly, couldn't attack. So when the army began to move, they were able to hold off the army. The Air Force wasn't coming in. They were able to hold off the army. They gained a few more days. The whole thing took about 10 days, and about 350,000 troops survived and went back to England, and they were the ones they regrouped, and they were the ones ultimately that were able to fight back. So you see again, who did he trust? When it came to a decision between the army represented reality in this case, because they were dealing with the reality of that situation, the military. Goering was a man with a subjective, you see? Goering was a man like himself, a man who admired Hitler, who had the same subjective. He went along with Goering to the denial of external reality. That's the second thing. All right, there's more types. Let me just, I want to make one more point here. There's another reason why Derech Hashem Tovei, and you see this illustrated in the Megillah. Any system, you see, has the same problem. There's no system in the world, no matter how perfect it is, that's going to always function perfectly and not make errors, not make mistakes. I'm talking about a good system, the system of Yadus. You set up a system with the correct people and good thinkers, and no matter what it is, there's always going to be a point of mistakes, errors, downfall. It's impossible. Where you see that in the Torah? There's what? Tshuva. Tshuva. Now, what is the Torah? In order for the system to survive, the system must have built into it a mechanism, right, which, after it's made a mistake and it's suffering bad consequences, to get yourself out of that situation and to go back on the path to reality. What is that? That's the system of tshuva. How do we see, where do we see that it's fit into the system, that it's ingrained into the system? The Rambam in Hilchos Tainis. The Rambam says that any tzara, any time there's an, read the first Rambam in Hilchos Tainis, any time a national calamity occurs to the Jewish people, a calamitous event, so what do people have to get together and declare a fast? And what's a fast? A fast is really tshuva. What is tshuva? Tshuva really means, again, what is the chait? The chait means that your inner reality was not in line with the external. Tshuva means you have to readjust the internal to the truth, to the external. What happened in the Megillah? When Mordechai heard about the news that the plan for the Jews to be exterminated, what did he do? He dressed himself in sackcloth and ashes, and what else did he go and do? Vayizak za'aka gedayla umara. He went out and he's loud and screaming, yelling. It's very interesting. I just want to mention a side point. There's a very good series on Channel 13 about the World War II, and a lot of it deals with the Holocaust. Last night was a very interesting segment. It deals with a very, very touchy, delicate issue. Yeah, which is a big machlekes today. It's a very sensitive type of a thing. So I have to watch my guard my words carefully over here. The big machlokas about how the American Jews, the Jews in the West in general, but America b'chlal, did they really do enough during World War II, during the Holocaust, to save the Jews? Could Jews, all kinds of questions. Did they know? When did they know? Could Jews have been saved? Was it a possible? All kinds of machlokas. In fact, they recently tried to set up a commission. Yeah, right now, right, this is an ongoing debate. In fact, they just recently tried to set up a commission, and it fell apart. The argument against the commission was that who is the commission? The very organizations that are being accused. The very organizations who are being accused of not doing enough are setting up the commission. Very interesting. I was just thinking in connection. Maybe, you know. They showed both sides. There were those Zionists who were trying to explain in those days you couldn't do anything, and Stephen Wise went to Roosevelt and you couldn't upset the ship, you couldn't make noises. Yeah, because it would be aroused anti-Semitism, all kinds of things like that. It turned out in the end that it wasn't true, that plenty could have been done. Because finally there was a big scandal. You read the book While 6 Million Died if you want to go into that parsha. While 6 Million Died shows how the American government really could have done a lot, but there was a squelch. Roosevelt, we know this is true. All right. Once. All right. I don't want to get into all the particulars. Things like this. So there was another side. There were guys like this guy Berkson, who was a nephew of Rav Kook, Zal. And he was one of those militant Jews who were really urging that the Jews take a more militant posture and to go out and demonstrate and really bring the plight of the Holocaust. In fact, they showed last night, a real Kiddush Hashem, because they showed that there was a group, the only public demonstration in Washington, a group of about 400 or 500 Orthodox rabbis gathered outside the Senate, and senators came down. There were men with beards and black coats were crying and, like really expressing their grief. And the senators came out, and then they wanted to do it in front of the White House. Because they had many senators that this guy Berkson was bringing as a riot, that had the Jews gone out, he said, had they gone out and rent their garments publicly and yelled and screamed about the terrible tragedy, the Gentile world would have been affected. The Rav one time said the very same thing. He said, you see from Mordechai, what did Mordechai do? Vayizak, he put on sack and ashes. Vayizak za'aka gedayla umara. He went out and he screamed a loud and mournful cry. And he said that I believe that my memory serves correct. He was referring to, this is what we failed to do. At the very least, you know, I mean, we're not talking about Milton Seaway, you bomb Bill. I'm not talking about that. But in other words, to rent your garments, and he says they could, the Jews could have gone out and screamed a loud and mournful cry. He said it last night, Berkson. He said the Jews could have gone out and rent their garments. I don't know if he didn't have in mind the Megillah, but it reminded me what the Rebbe said. So what was the first reaction? When Esther finally was convinced that she has to do something, what was the first reaction? Tshuva. 3-day fast. Exactly. What does that mean? Perfection of the self. That's how the tzaddik operates. Before the tzaddik operates in the world of the external, of reality, he deals with the external. He can't deal with the external until he deals with the internal. What's my position? Where do I stand in line? Am I in line with reality? Or am I out of line with reality? So first they had to readjust their own state. That's tshuva. However, the Torah believes, you can't, it's not enough just to perfect yourself in the tshuva and God will save you, because God wants you to operate within the framework of reality. Except there's two different ways to operate in the framework of reality. In other words, everybody has to get reality to conform to his needs. Otherwise you'll never eat. So you'll say that, you could ask that question. Conquer of a city to satisfy reality. So if you go out and you earn some money, you make, you're also trying to change reality. Ah, there's difference. In other words, Ki Yodei Ado Shem Derech Tzadikim. God knows the way of Tzadikim. The Rambam says the way God set up the world is to conform to the true needs of man. The needs of man that are in line with his true nature, his true reality. He says people complain about how hard it is and how I have to suffer and work so hard for money and so on and so forth, how tough it is in the world. He says the fault is because they are not living in line with their true nature. If a person lived in line with his true needs, he would see how easy it is. I mean, if he realized, if he was only concerned with the physical world in terms of true necessities, and his real happiness came from Torah and knowledge, then the world, it would be very easy to get by in the world. 99% of all the difficulty and travail and suffering is because he's trying to satisfy his, not his real needs, but his created, his imaginary, his luxuries, his tivus. So that was part two. The first step was, the first step was tshuva, to correct the deficiency in the self, to adjust the self. Once that is done, part two is, now you got to deal with reality. Tremendous chachma. She worked it out. She was dealing in line with reality, the plan. You see, she had a tremendous plan worked out. Every step that she took was worked out with tremendous chachma. The way she went to Achashverosh, she wasn't supposed to, and then how she set up the two parties and this, and everything was done with tremendous... And then later on, the way she explained the cause, that it wasn't for her own sake, or for the, but it was for the sake of the king. Everything she did was operating in the framework of chachma, yeah? But he saw that the people were going to sleep through the calamity. In other words, there was a calamity during World War II, the Holocaust. Somebody had to yell, arouse them from their slumber. There's a calamity going on. You can't just sleep. You can't just go on life as normal. That's these Akkadei Lamara. Then you start, then once you realize the calamity, then introspection, and then operating in the framework of reality. Yeah. Now, one second. That is basically, you see, the Derech Tzadikim. Because even Tzadikim, it's a tshuva, it's part of the nature of man. I mean, nobody's perfect, there's always mistakes. The Derech Hashayim Toved, well, it must fail, it must go to destruction, because what happens when he makes a mistake? Hitler made many mistakes during the court. Dunkirk was the first of the mistakes. With these generals, Hitler insisted on holding back the German tanks. 48 hours later, he reversed the decision. But then it was too late. The British had used the unexpected respite to strengthen their defenses and were able to hold off the Germans long enough to complete their evacuation. The first of Hitler's military mistakes was to have momentous consequences for the future of the war. You see, how does the Russia react to a... how does he react to a mistake? Well, how does he react to it? Denial. He can't face... See, he can't face up to that. He can't face up. A chacham uses a method, a derech. So he made a mistake, you correct the method. But the Russia, it's all the self. A mistake means a defect in the self, and he can't face the defect in the self. So therefore, what does he do? Total denial. Now, what happens when a person denies? When a person senses a weakness in himself, and he can't face it, he wants to deny it, what is he going to do? He'll go to an even crazier measure. he'll go to the exact reaction formation. So what did he do? He went from mistake to mistake. He couldn't admit that there was something wrong. So then he initiated the bombing of Britain. He tried to wipe them out from the air, and that failed. When that failed, did he learn from that mistake? No. Then he took on Russia. When that failed, what did he do? He took on America. He began taking on more and more and more until the whole world was against him. You see? In other words, when the Russia makes a mistake, he cannot face up to the reality. So therefore, what does he have to do? He has to deny the reality. But when he denies the reality, he has to go on a more instinctive course. You see, he has to go in the opposite direction. That's why V'derech Rishayim Toved. That's the whole story of the Megillah. See, the Megillah really shows the life of the Russia, who lives in the subjective framework of reality, and the life of the Tzaddik, who lives in the objective framework. See, in other words, in terms of adjustment, the Kovish is Yitzro, adjusting the self in order to conform to the true nature of reality, and then, of course, using tremendous chachma in order to obtain the legitimate necessities. And then, of course, it also illustrates, you see, that, of course, God has two worlds. There's the world of nature, as Ari Chayes pointed out, the last resume, the world of nature, and then there's the world of Hashgacha. And, of course, you see Hashgacha, too, that Hashgacha, God operates and bypasses or overrides the forces of nature in order to secure the existence of the people that have the true ideas. All right, now I'm just repeating an idea that has been expressed in some of the recent shiurim. One second, I just want to sum it all up, because somebody raised the issue of Midrashim recently. That actually this whole shiur, Derech Rishayim Toved, can be summed up in a particular Midrash. I tried to explain that a lot of the times you read the Midrashic statements of the rabbis, and on the surface, a lot of these things sound totally crazy. So people, people sometimes get the wrong idea. We say that the Chazal were tremendous Chacham who understood the Torah, who understood reality, and all of their statements reflect great wisdom. Then you come across some of the statements, and they sound like totally preposterous, like they were living in a totally different world, totally crazy. Now, we said that, well, what do you do in a case like that? You have to realize that these statements also, right, contain tremendous chachma, but they express themselves in a different way. These statements have to be decoded. Let me give you an example. Og Melech HaBashan. Without going again into every prat, you'll see, tell me what they're talking about. If they're not talking about all the things we discussed right now. Please. I have the English translation. It's a three-volume set. It's called The Book of Legends, Tales from the Talmud and Midrash. It's in English, so it's easy to read. So he talks about what a great giant Og was. Moses feared to wage war against this giant. But God assured him that he would conquer Og, as he had conquered Og's brother Sichon. So the Midrash is telling us, if you read the story in the Chumash, that he fought against Og and he conquered him. Now the Midrash is telling us the background story. When the giant, meaning Og, discovered that the camp of Israel was three parasangs in circumference, I don't know how much a parasang is, it doesn't matter. He pulled up a mountain of three parasangs, laid it upon his head, and came marching in the direction of the camp of Israel, to hurl the mountain upon them. But God caused ants to perforate the mountain, so that it slipped down on Og's neck. The giant tried to shake the mountain off, but his teeth suddenly extended and projected in all directions, so as to prevent the mountain from slipping off. The giant now remained standing before the camp of Israel, with the mountain on his head, unable to throw or shake it off. When Moses saw this, he took an axe 12 cubits long, leaped 10 cubits into the air, and dealt a blow upon Og's ankle, which made him stumble. The mountain came down upon him and caused his death. The entire land of Bashan now fell into the hands of the Israelites. What are they trying to tell us? It's just basic steps over here. Does anybody get the... We have to just decode and reinterpret. Step one. When the giant discovered that the camp of Israel was three parasangs in circumference, he pulled up a mountain of three parasangs, laid it on his head, and came marching in the direction of the camp of Israel to hurl the mountain upon them. What does it show you?
Chachma.
The Rasha operates with Chachma. He studied the situation. At that particular stage, you see, he was not in conflict with reality, other than in terms of his emotional. But he wanted to effectuate his emotional desire in a realistic way. Hitler also. Reason. Developed technology. See, now what happens? God caused ants to perforate the mountain so that it slipped down on Og's neck. What's that? No, that's the conflicts. When it says God caused, I don't know if necessarily it means, it could be Ashkacha. You know, that's
natural.
See, God caused, it could mean God caused because it's ingrained in nature. Yeah, God is the cause of nature. The ants represent the conflicts, the difficulties, you see. So what did he try and do? He tried to shake it off and his teeth extended. He couldn't deal with it in a rational way. So he went crazier, this way, that way, his teeth standing up, and all, right, to the extent that he's now, like you see Hitler did, instead of it destroying himself. In other words, he tried to shake it off. Shaking it off means he didn't stop, and at that point, rationality ceased to function, and he operated in a purely emotional way, so the teeth extended, and he got caught up, this got caught up over there, until he's so tied down, in such a weakened position, that now the person with Chachma, you see, now the person who was operating with Chachma can study the situation, can see the vulnerability, and go in and destroy him. That's basically the whole thing. Okay. Yeah. The ants mean even a small thing in reality.
No, but it's also
the multitude. You learn reality. So you detect the cause, and you get yourself in line with reality.
That's the internal.
Correcting
the
internal.
That's
right, that's right. All right, maybe later. I'm tired now.